Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Matt Truman and we're back today at the Radar Festival at the Bush Theatre in London. With me today is the writer and performer Kieran Hurley. Kieran's work has a direct political edge, be it recounting his own journey to the G8 summit in L'Aquila in 2009, as in his monologue Hitch, harking back to the rave culture of the early 90s in Beats, for which he won Best Play at the Critics Awards for Theatre in Scotland, or revisiting the recent London riots in his new play Chalk Farm, which premiered at Oran Moor in September. Kieran, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Cheers, Matt.
Pleasure. So, Kieran, I thought because we're here at the Radar Festival, subtitle of which is Signals from the New Writing World, and the ideas of what does it mean to be classed as new writing today, I thought I'd start by noting that you avoid the term playwright. Why is that?
Well, I think that I will do that less and less, to be honest with you. I think early on in my career, if you like, around about the time I was making Hitch, I would never have identified with the term playwright. I didn't think I was allowed to be one because I was writing something that was for me to speak and that wasn't fictional, and I guess I hadn't really interrogated the term well enough, and I just sort of came through a culture of, like, cut my teeth in, if you like, a culture of sort of quite collaborative, devised work that often didn't start from text. And so that was the kind of stuff that I was kicking around doing when I was a student and shortly afterwards, and I just didn't think that I was a playwright, and then wrote this piece. I wrote and performed this piece, Hitch, which got nominated for a playwright award for the same Cats Award that Beats won later, and sort of since then, a colleague and a friend, Alan McKendrick, who is a playwright based in Scotland as well, sort of approached me about unionising, about joining the Scottish Society of Playwrights, and I was like, oh no. Couldn't possibly, because I'm not one of you. And he's talked me around, increasingly, I'm increasingly more and more comfortable with it. I think it carries, I know lots of other people that aren't comfortable with it who make similar work to me, and I think it's because it carries a huge weight of cultural baggage around the type of work that people expect from that word, from play and from playwright. I've just decided to kind of ignore that a little bit and just accept that if other people are going to call what I'm doing a play and going to call what I'm doing playwriting, then that's fine. And also, you know, you can get in that whole discussion of breaking down the word, and it's not actually about, you know, it's the whole write as in wrought iron. You're someone who crafts play, who creates a context for play to happen in, who sculpts play. And I'm like, well, yeah, I can get on board with that.
So to a certain extent, then, is it about removing that definite article of a play and shifting it towards play?
I guess so, maybe. I think, although actually the thing about, say, the Hitch or Beats is that there is a play there. There's a written document, you know. So in my work, then, actually, yes and no, and that the play remains, you know. Although a lot of people in the established world of a playwriting tradition and new writing have told me that they couldn't possibly call it a play or put it on or whatever because it's too much like stand-up in form. So I find that interesting.
Yeah.
So basically these words are contestable and they're up for grabs, and there's a lot of connotations that the word playwright carries that I don't think I find necessarily helpful in describing my work, but there's also a lot of it that I do find useful too. And in Scotland, there's quite a clear tradition of playwriting while that can be stifling in some ways, there's also a lineage there that I'm quite proud to be able to call myself a part of a continuing story of. Do you know? I'd actually rather not just burn the bridges with what's gone before me in that way. Do you know? Does that make any sort of sense?
Absolutely.
So it's like it carries some connotations that I like and others that I like less, and then I just sort of live with it, really. And then sometimes I don't use it and sometimes I do, depending on who I'm talking to and what's most likely going to get my work on or get me paid for it. So sometimes I'm a theatre maker, sometimes I'm a playwright. Both are fine.
Yeah. So let's start with Beat, because it's why you're here at Radar Festival.
That's true, yes.
Tell us about Beat and sort of what it is. It's the story of a Livingston-based teenager, John O'Macready.
That's the one, yeah. So, Beats is set in the mid-90s, at the time when the government were introducing a piece of legislation, which was the Criminal Justice Act of 1994, which did many, many, many things around civil liberties, and one of the most notable and most significant for this show was a sort of attempt to outlaw rave culture through legislation which specifically targeted unlicensed public gatherings around music wholly or predominantly characterised by the emission of a succession of repetitive beats, which I just think is a really lovely quote. It's just the language of someone attempting to legislate for and describe and explain away something that they have no concept of, because of course almost all music has repetitive beats. But I was always really interested in this. I guess I used to be kind of more into that techno and stuff as well at a point in my life, and I was always kind of interested in this recent historical moment that did a lot of interesting things in terms of politicising a generation around a movement that had otherwise ostensibly organised around being hedonistic. Sure, a lot of people were aware of the political implications of the kind of subculture that they were a part of, but for many, many, many others, that wasn't what it was about at all. But then you have your way of life repressed and you become politicised, and that actually shaped the whole shape of like direct action protest in the UK after that, because you had like the Reclaim the Streets movement and all sorts of stuff to do with the whole party protest movement and stuff. That's not what the show's about. The show is just about a young boy, John O'Macready, from small town Scotland, who Livingston, who goes to a rave, gets out his box, has some interesting things happen to him, and comes home, really. The interesting thing to me, Matt, about the Criminal Justice Act is that what you have is an ostensibly non-political movement that someone in power is still threatened enough by to want to legislate against it.
Yep.
And so this idea of young people gathering en masse in a way in which that is outside of the orthodoxies of control, or being something that people are threatened by in some way. And so, but yet the unharnessed potential of all that. There was just something interesting for me about at the time the Occupy movement was happening, and Milbank had just happened and stuff at the time I was writing it. And there seemed to be something really interesting about people being frightened of young people getting together and sharing space together in a meaningful way. And so there was it just felt like an appropriate time to look at that sort of moment a little bit. And so I guess, yeah, I could prattle on for ages about what I think the show is about. There's all sorts of stuff in there to do with what it means to be living in the landscape of post-Thatcher Britain as well, about a search for community and solidarity or something against quite a lonely backdrop of cultural isolation, really. So that's kind of what this kid is doing in the show. He's the youngest of a generation that would grow up to be known as Thatcher's children. The world that he's grown in has been sort of that he's grown up in is one that's already been decimated, where values of solidarity and sort of working class collectivism or whatever have begun to be systematically eroded. He doesn't have a language for all this. He just knows that it's pish, and he wants to go and find something a little bit more meaningful.
Mm.
And that's sort of his journey, really. That's sort of what he's about. But then I also try and paint the policeman quite sympathetically as well.
It was one of the things that I really picked up on actually when I saw it up in Edinburgh, the Traverse this year.
Well, everyone down here calls it the Traverse, so and actually that probably is more correct a use of the word, but yeah.
I get told off every year actually.
The Traverse is what we call it. We're sticking to it.
It really struck me that there was perhaps a surprising, after Hitch, empathy and understanding for the character of the policeman who's essentially just turning up to do his job in clearing this rave.
Yeah, well, he's from Motherwell, that character. He's just another, it's the idea of a policeman just being another worker, really. I hope that I don't let him off too lightly, but I definitely wanted to portray him as deeply human, and he's actually one of the characters that I feel, when I'm performing it, that I feel like one of the strongest connections with, which is quite odd, really.
And One of the things that struck me about the piece is the way that it kind of needs that word beat, by which I mean it sort of folds this subject in on itself and looks at it from all these different angles, be it the repetitive beats of history, the way that tick follows tock follows tick follows tock, be it the physical action of wading into a group of people and with a baton, and just sort of really plays around with the angles that it looks at the subject from. How do you approach that?
I don't know, I think that's something that just sort of came about, you know, when I'm writing it, it's like you know, you find a little groove that works, and sort of work that a little while and see what else is in there. Do you know, like there's a recurring image of a heart, of a beating heart that sort of recurs about halfway through the, it's introduced about halfway through the play, if you like, and this becomes a bit of a recurring image. So there's heartbeats in there as well, and there's something about a human connectedness through that as well. So it's just one of those words that has many, many meanings, and I mean, it's quite useful, so it makes for quite a useful title in that sense. There was a bit in an early draft where there was a backstory around Jono's character where it was to do with his dad, who doesn't feature in the show at all, and his dad was ill and had a dodgy ticker or a dodgy heart, and then I realised I was pushing that too far. There's this ticking clock in the background of his mum's scene, and then there was the heartbeats and the beat in the ticker. I was like, nah, you know, you're writing a series of puns now, Kieran. You need to just cut that out. But yes, certainly there's a thing in the show that is about looking at these little beats, these little moments in these different narratives, and finding joins and connections between them. There's something that's about connectivity in that way.
But it also, I mean, it also brings a sense of rhythm to the piece, which seems, I mean, we haven't mentioned so far that you're on stage with a DJ.
With Johnny Whoop,
Johnny Whoop, who's playing all the way through. And actually, I mean, one of the clever things, going back to the piece of legislation that we discussed, is that this is, as an event, as long as you get more than six people in the audience, this is in itself an illegal event.
I play around with that in the beginning. I kind of infer that is the case at the beginning of the show in a sort of cheeky way, because it is and it isn't, in that it matches that particular extract of the legislation's definition, but elsewhere in the legislation, I'm pretty sure, it shows you how little research I've done, I couldn't tell you exactly what it says, but I'm pretty sure that if there's a licence for the event and it's indoors, that you're safe. So being in a theatre, it's actually totally legit. And I used to have that at the top of the show when I did the work in progress of it very early on. It was only 20 minutes long. I was just be like, but you know, we're indoors and these guys have got a licence and it's all totally legit, so don't worry about it. And then I just thought, I'm just not going to say that. because it's a playful poke at the absurdity of the legislation that remains in the show, even if I'm being quite willfully disingenuous, I think, which I hold my hands up now and say.
But it raises the spectre, I suppose, of certain types of culture, good, other types of
bad. Exactly, right, yeah, exactly.
And theatre, I mean, classically, is this very sort of nice, well-behaved, open quotation marks, middle class activity.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose that also looks wider to the nature of your work and your interests. I know you're doing a PhD in, is it contemporary performance training and political disobedience?
Yeah, that was a working title from a while ago. It's gone through very, very, very many, many, many other ones. What I'm looking at a lot of activist performance art, essentially, and looking at training practices and pedagogies within a lot of contemporary activist performance art. I've been spending a bit of time with people doing rebel clown trainings in Glasgow and stuff like that.
What's rebel clown?
Rebel clowning was something that was really, really significant around about the time of the 2005 Glen Eagles G8. There was a big movement around it in the UK, and then some of it sort of spread, went global, and some of it still sort of stays alive. A lot of where people use some of the practices and strategies of clowning as a performance mechanism, if you like, to sort of subvert the dominant behaviours of like a protest, you know. So you the classic image that you see that sort of on the internet or whatever is like someone is this girl with a clown face on, like kissing a riot shield of a police officer, you know. So
Okay, but
the PhD is a whole other thing.
I was really interested in, given this sort of this safety this nice well-rounded border around theatre.
Yeah.
How you as a theatre maker use theatre in some way as activism.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's funny because I always get really wary of saying that because I get annoyed at other people when they say that. When they say, oh yeah, I used to be involved in so much like activist grassroots work, but now I think my theatre is my activism. And I'm like, yeah, it's kind of convenient that it pays you as well. And that's not the case for a lot of people's activisms. So I think, again, I think it's too easy for people to say that a lot of the time. But I do, at the same time, also want to totally stand up for not just theatre's right for, but necessity for it being an important place of those of like civic dialogue. Do you know? I believe that theatre is a place where we can ask some really interesting, important questions in a way that's, I think, is better equipped for asking those questions than a lot of other places that we have.
Sure.
And that's why I'm here. I'm always wary to try and keep myself in check to not take too much the cosy line of saying, yeah, my theatre is my activist practice. It is and it isn't. Do you know? It is, and it's also important to do other things too.
I mean, if nothing else, it strikes me that it extends the life of the act. I mean, Hitch, for example, your travelling out to L'Aquila has therefore had a much wider
resonance
is
it? And it's funny, it's a funny one. It's a show that I still really like performing. I'll maybe begin to perform it less and less as we go into next year. But there's something really gentle about its politics, actually. It's actually really just a story about a journey, and about it's a similar sort of narrative structure, actually. It's a search for solidarity, and it's a story about that journey towards that. The politics in it are actually quite light, and sometimes I actually think that I let the G8 a little bit lightly off the hook in that show as well. But these are just the frustrations that I have with it because it's autobiographical, and so every time I do it, I question the me that's represented on stage. I go, that's not really what I think of. I'm not really that much of a what, do you know, because the me in it is really just a narrative construct.
Sure.
You know? So those are, I guess, I wonder if those concerns are just specific to myself.
So then it comes back to this idea of being a playwright.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah. So Hitch is a show where I'm talking in quite an anecdotal way to the audience with very few trinkets. There's music that by a band called Over the Wall. There's projected images by the artist Julia Todlin. And it's really, really low key, but that's all a deliberate decision, you know. So it looks like it's just me talking about my holiday, basically. But the me that's talking to you is two steps removed from actually being me.
This, I suppose, this is another element that is coming in very strongly at the Bush as part of this festival. Is the idea of writing absolutely inherently, intrinsically linked to the person performing that writing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, I felt that with both the pieces I've seen of you, that kind of, yes, someone else could perform them, but there's something about the level of comfort, the level of ownership, the ease with that material that you bring to it, that I think, I was reading Chris Goode, who described Hitch as the greatest performance he'd ever seen in The Observer, and he borrowed Paul Goodman's term, masterly adequacy, which
it's
is
lovely,
just
isn't
spot
it?
On.
It's simply, singularly the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me, so thanks, Chris. I mean, the beats is there's more of a distance because it's a fiction and I'm really obviously playing characters. I'm actually getting to be a bit of an actor in a way that I quite enjoy. It's quite fun, you know.
You should point out for the sake that the open quotation marks was made around
the square quotes came out. So that's good. But nevertheless, people have commented on how they don't think someone else could perform it. Mm-hmm. But I would like to think maybe someone could if they wanted to. But there is still very much a me, the storyteller, is the most present thing in the room.
Yeah.
And that's something that we're seeing more and more of, I think. But what's something that I'm beginning to do more and more of is write for other performers, which I'm quite enjoying and finding a little bit of a sort of interesting journey. Watching the Chalk Farm, which you mentioned at the top, which is a piece that I co-wrote with Julia Todovan, and Julia performs in it, but the other performer when it opened at Oran Mór in Glasgow was a young actor called Sean Brown, who was great. And just watching it and sitting in the audience was the most nerve-wracking, horrible thing that I've ever done working in theatre. And I don't know how all these comfortably conventional playwrights do it. And I said that to lots of playwright friends. I was like, how on earth can you do that every time? And they're like, it's horrible, isn't it? It doesn't get any better. So
What exactly was the sensation? What was...
Something about not being in control. It makes me sound terrible. It makes me sound like a horrible person. But something about, I don't mean control in any kind of commandeering or abusive sense. I just mean having agency with the with that live thing that is the relationship with the audience.
Yeah.
You know, in Beats, I've written this thing, and Johnny shares the stage with me, and that's great. And Jamie's doing all these amazing visuals, and there's lots of other people that are commandeering that sort of live event with me, but I'm there and I'm on stage and I can make eye contact with people and I can be in it. And also something about just getting your game face on so that you don't have to deal with your critical questions about whether or not it's any good,
yeah,
because you have to just get you'd have to just put on your work clothes really,
yep,
and just show up and do it and then deal with whether or not it was any good or not afterwards. Whereas sitting in the audience in the dark, you have neither any agency in that relationship of like, it's over to them, and that's great. And when it works, and which it did with Chalk Farm, it's so liberating and exciting, and I loved it. But also for the first night, it's just like, I was so not used to that experience, so not used to being able to being allowed or critical distance at the opening of something that I'd written. I found it. And it's very emotionally challenging.
There's something very interesting in this then, given your background and your sort of emergence from collaborative practice, devising. One might have thought that you as a writer were sort of in the mould of, yeah, this is a text, go play, do what you will with it.
Yeah, yeah.
In that, I think Simon Stevens is probably the example, as it were. And yet there's some sense of this is...
Well, because actually when I've been making a show like Beats, for example, the process is so not about me developing a text on my own and then giving it to someone else and saying, go what you want with it. Mm. Like, that's one model of that willingness to let go is one model of really collaborative practice. And you mentioned Simon Stevens. But the way in which I've collaborated in the past has always been that the text has emerged through a collaborative practice with other people in the room. So with Johnny in the room for Beats, there was almost this dramaturgy by music where he was bringing in these tracks from the 90s, and I was like, I have to write to that track now, actually, because that has to, that, I don't know why, but that has to be where the story goes. Do you know what? So there's this like emergence of it. So yes, a real comfort with collaboration, but just not, I'm really comfortable in theory with the idea of me sitting down writing something, giving it to someone and saying, you run away with that and do whatever you want now. Like, that excites me. I think that sounds great. It's just never been how I've worked before.
Yeah.
So like that whole idea of writing and just handing it over for someone else to be like, it's not the theoretical idea of someone else taking my work and adapting it. Like Selma's piece in Exempt magazine, like you read that, that's like, she speaks about someone taking one of her plays in a direction that she would never have imagined. That's Selma Dmitrievich, by the way, of Grayscale Theatre, for the listeners. And that sounds really exciting. That sounds brilliant. So I don't have any bones with that as an idea. It's just that the experience of being in the audience and not being involved in that relationship with them and not commandeering that sort of live event from the stage was not one I was used to, and sure, so I felt powerless and sort of like scared, I think. You know, it's an experience of, it's a transitional thing, an experience of letting go that I guess you maybe become more used to, but people have assured me that you don't.
Yeah. And Chalk Farm is about the 2011 riots, is that right?
Yeah, it was co-written with Julia, and Julia and I have collaborated on a number of other things. She's the co-director on Beats. This is Julia Todovan, who's an actor and writer and theatre maker. She was the co-director on Beats and Hitch. And we just decided that we were going to co-write a thing. And we both really wanted to respond to the riots after they happened. To respond to people's response to them, actually. We had this sort of mystifying and saddening thing where, like, you know, people that you thought you liked on Twitter saying things like, what are cannons now? Like, using all sorts of really dehumanising language. And just think, whoa, guys, where is the wider discourse here? Where is the demonisation of young working class people just being the baseline go-to position, which we found really surprising and troubling. And we wanted to just kind of explore that, really. There was a big question always about legitimacy of voice. The riots never happened in Scotland, you know, let alone in Glasgow, when you're coming off of the border as well. And so there's that, you know, and it's specifically rooted in Chalk Farm. That's the place where we chose. We've done a lot, we did a lot of research, but we didn't do any verbatim style interviews. And so there was an interesting thing there, an interesting dilemma there about who you can and can't write for. We just decided that the themes we were exploring, which we felt were about class and a broken society, we really see that in Glasgow, and it really affects us in Glasgow too. And we thought, well, actually, yeah, I think we can write these characters with a degree of empathy and humanity. But we'll see. We've never put it on in London. I think that'll be the real acid test of that. We went down really well in Glasgow, but I would like to stage that show in front of a London audience just to see what the response is there. Actually,
is it heading for a future line?
We hope so. It was originally commissioned by the Oran Moore, who run the Play a Pint of Pint season in Glasgow, and it went for a week there, and we were really happy with it. It went well. We would like to develop aspects of it. We are hoping that there might be the possibility of some kind of fringe 2013 life for it, but there is no there's no structures in place for that yet at the moment, so there's no guarantees. I'm confident it'll have another life because we wanted to, so something will happen. But exactly what yet? There's nothing pinned down that I can actually talk about.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing it at some point.
Yeah, and then nice one, man. I hope you get to.
Kieran, thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt. Cheers.